Welcome to the Aftershock Central Podcast with Ronnie. See, this is take two. We started recording and I forgot to hit record. With Travis and Martin. Welcome, Travis.
Martini.
Damn it, you did it. But nobody will know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who is Martini?
Who is Martini? That'd be a good episode title. Good episode title. We have
hashtag
who is Martini. We have five books to talk
about. Let's get that hashtag training.
Let's not get that hashtag training. I disapprove of this. Travis, we don't have time for jokes, man. There's too many books. And we already wasted 10 minutes by me not hitting record. First up, we are discussing Orphan Age. Brand new book that came out last week, so we'll talk about this week's books immediately after. Orphan Age number 1, written by Ted Anderson, with art by Nuno Plotti, letters by Joe Lemos, letters by Marshall Dillon. All right, Travis, we should recap our fantastic conversation that somebody forgot to record about this book.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. So, yeah, like, it never is the same second time through, so.
That's true.
Sorry, folks.
Now we already know what we think about this book.
It's just, I don't know, it's like, it's a podcasting rule. It's you can't capture lightning in a bottle twice.
I disagree. We're professionals.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so to recap, you know, my point was that there's a lot of post-apocalypse stories out there, you know, both in comics and in other media, you know, and like there's always some different reason for like what happened, you know, and you know, like I won't go into all the examples, but you know, obviously the unique premise here is that the apocalypse hinges around some event where all of the adults in the world die. So all that's left are children. My point to that is that if that is what makes this a novel story, I wish that we had seen what happens right after that, because that to me seems pretty damn interesting. You know, like you have a world full of kids and how are they going to like, you know, make do, you know? Case in point, there's a doctor in this issue. How'd she become a doctor if everybody in the world was kids?
Yeah, I think I was trying to figure that out as well. I mean, my assumption is that they just call her doctor because that's kind of the name for a healer beforehand. My assumption is obviously she doesn't have a degree, right? There's no school for her to go to become a doctor. But maybe her dad or her mom was a doctor and she's got books where she can look up whatever anatomy or like symptoms of things. And she might have some basic skills. It could even be something even simpler than that. Maybe she was just like a Girl Scout. You know what I mean? So she like knows how to bandage people. And like that's the extent of her ability. But that's more than most of these kids would have. I mean, I don't know. Considering that they've had no adults, I'm sure a lot of these kids have some pretty advanced survival skills, I would assume, right? It's not like you can piece a society together right away, right? And this takes place, I think, 20 years is what they said after the adults all died. So, I mean, that's probably enough time for these kids to develop some kind of skills. But yeah, I was curious about the doctor. To your point, though, I mean,
that's an interesting story, you know?
I mean, you're right. We may never get that story because, spoiler alert, she's dead. I mean, we can assume she's dead. But you do get a couple flashbacks.
Well, you know, they're going off in a different direction. Yeah.
Yeah. So you get a flashback at the beginning, which kind of sets up the story. And then, like, you sort of get a flashback a few pages in when, I guess the kids, I mean, most of them are adults now or getting into adulthood. They do like a open mic night, I guess, where they could just share like what's troubling them. And you do have that story that one kid tells about the nightmares he's having, where he's remembering things that happened at this event. But it is kind of tossed aside pretty quickly. And the point that I was making before I forgot to hit record, my bad, I blame it on Ronnie because he's not here, is that maybe we, number one, I don't know if we necessarily need too much of that, And number two, with this being a assumedly miniseries, do we have enough room in this book to do a lot of flashbacks? Because the characters that you meet at the beginning of the book end up not being the main characters of the book either, right? You have the girl, Princess. She ends up being a main character. You have this guy that just shows up out of nowhere. And then the girl that's playing guitar. Like, those are your main characters, but they don't play a key role in the story until the last couple pages.
Well, I assume that the guy that got, you know, showed up shot was an adult version of the kid we see in the beginning. That's what I assumed. And, like, you know, it's unclear, like, what happened to his sister in the intervening years. So I imagine that's going to come up if they took the trouble to show her in the beginning. But, yeah, I mean, it was an interesting kind of swerve very early on that, like, they set that up, you know, like, for kind of maximum impact to, like, that you, like, you think it's going to be one thing, and then, you know, very, very quickly, all those characters that you got to know are gone.
Yeah, I agree. I found it pretty interesting, the setup on, like, the introduction of the villains, right? Or the bad guys. And you know, you were saying how to you this is kind of novel, and I mentioned previously this show, Jeremiah, that this reminded me a lot of. I think even in Jeremiah, one of the counter groups to the heroes was kind of this, like, religious sect that had sprung up after the adults died. I could be mixing it up with the other show that I got this mixed up with, Jericho. But I vaguely remember something like that happening. And that's not a bad thing at all. I think I really enjoyed that show. So if there's some inspiration that was gotten out of that, then I'm all for it. I'm really digging this. Because that show didn't last very long. I think it was like a couple seasons. I'm glad this is around. Because you're right. This is not a typical post-apocalyptic story. It is very different. I think once we get rolling a little bit, as our trio is roaming through the countryside, we may get some more flashbacks, in particular relating to this one character that we see in the initial flashback. But aside from that, I don't know if we'll see, like, how society evolved over the past 20 years without any adults.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see kind of where it's going. I do agree kind of to your point that you know, obviously the church, like, seems like a major thematic element that they're hinting at, you know? And I think it's an interesting idea, you know, like, maybe, you know, maybe it's occurred to other people before, but, like, I can certainly see the church, like, capitalizing, or not even just churches, but, like, any kind of religion kind of capitalizing on disaster, you know, to kind of increase their own power and influence, you know? So I wonder if that's thematically what they're going for, you know, some kind of message along those lines.
Yeah. And I think to your point there, I think it's interesting to have the antagonist be a church group, cause that kind of makes sense to me, at least. I mean, they're based somewhere in Texas, I guess, from what I can tell on the map, maybe.
Dallas town.
So I'm assuming that area. And, you know, I mean, I lived in Texas. There's churches everywhere. Where I live now, there's churches on, like, every corner, you know? So I could see if you had some kind of apocalypse where there were no adults, but you had kids raised within a certain religious group, that those kids would somehow extrapolate how to live based on the beliefs that they were given, and maybe come to this place, right? Especially in a post-apocalyptic setting where your number one rule is to survive. And, you know, what better way to survive than to have this, like, zealous belief that, you know, what you're doing is right. And, you know, the adults died because they're all sinners. I mean, the leader of the group, the new church group, that's what he says, right? Like, it was a glorious day when this happened because all the sinners and the whores and all that, they all died. And that left us, the kids, to kind of take over, right? And that's a biblical thing too, right? Like, be like a child to come into my kingdom, something like that. It makes perfect sense that they would kind of hold on to this belief?
Well, like, my response to that would be, from what I understand, like, the typical kind of Christian reading is that, like, there's the rapture, right? But that's, isn't that the good people that get taken away? And everybody who doesn't go to heaven, like, stays on earth in the end times? So it's kind of a, like, a flip of that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I was going to make a comparison to, like, what I understand maybe The Leftovers to be, but I've never seen the show, so that's probably ill-advised.
I could definitely see some Leftover themes in here. I didn't watch the last season, but I watched the first couple. So, yeah, I could see that. And, I mean, you can take any religious doctrine to mean really whatever you want, right, based on whatever the current circumstances are. So they can definitely reinterpret whatever beliefs they were raised with in order to account for their actual situation at the moment.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. Like, my point earlier was kind of that, like, you know, what it's possible that it's not entirely, like devoutly held, that, you know, like, really there could just be a group with guns who, you know, want to secure supplies and ensure their own safety, you know, and they just, like, they wrap themselves in religion or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, we'll see, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. I love the fact that they're just called New Church, because, like, what would kids name it? You know what I mean? Like, adults always come up with these fancy names for churches, right? Not to demean, like, any church names, but, like, Church of Latter-day Saints, like, something that sounds super fancy. And, like, kids wouldn't have that vocabulary, so you have Old Church and you have New Church. So, yeah, we're going to call it New Church. I thought that was pretty clever.
Well, I've been watching, what's it called? American Gods.
Yeah.
And, like, it keeps, like, flashing in my head because they keep referring to the new gods.
Yeah.
And I'm like, new gods! So maybe New Church is like that.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Cool, let's write this one up.
Sorry.
No, you're fine.
Okay, one final thought for you.
Yeah.
Just one final thought. Okay, so I thought it was interesting that they kind of make reference to a plan that Princess has to go to Albany.
Yeah.
That seems to me like it predates this attack happening.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems rather specific. And, yeah, like, obviously, like, the whole thing now, I assume, is going to be, like, getting to Albany. But what's there, you know?
Yep. Yes. I agree.
Steamed hams. Yes!
Oh, Lord. Sure, why not?
Yeah. Okay, and yeah, like, thought two for that train of thought is road trip.
All right, let's rate this up, Travis. Give me a score.
All right, I'll go 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I'm there with you. I'll go 4 out of 5 as well. Fantastic. All right, I'm going to let you pick the next book.
Okay. How about Mary Shelley, Monster Hunter?
Man, that's what I had already up. You are psychic.
New book, dude.
New book, Mary Shelley, Monster Hunter, written by Adam Glass and Olivia Quartero Briggs, with art by Hayden Sherman, letters by Sal Cipriano. This was cool. I love the way that the book is written, because it is written as if you were reading a novel from that era, from the Romantic era. And I think that makes perfect sense. Number one, because a lot of this is narrated by Mary Shelley. But even the stuff that happens in the present, aside from the dialogue, is kind of told in that style. Because it's kind of interweaving the story of Mary Shelley with what I assume was the tour person for the Shelley house.
Yes. Like, in the beginning, it's isn't it the... Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. My question for you along those lines is, do you read at all that the kind of, like, the frame narrative, do you think that that's actually coming from the, like, lost manuscript that's down in the floorboards?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that would make perfect sense. 'Cause otherwise, why else would she find the manuscript? Right? Like, it's teased super quickly, and then you have her hit this floorboard that's creaking, and she opens it up, and there's a book. And then that's when you start getting Mary Shelley's story. Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense.
And she, like, she says in that scene that, like, what if there was – some people think that there's a missing book, like, from that time period, mm-hmm. you know, like, from that year or whatever that they were in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. So I think that's my read on that, that, like, that's what they set up is just, like, oh, like, this is the story. And it kind of, in ways, like, the narrative is a little bit like how, like, Frankenstein starts, like, in very – vague
yeah,
ways.
Yeah, sure, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I like that. I like that thought a lot, actually. I also like, yeah, you know, Adam's really good at this historical fiction stuff, right? I mean, he's got a co-writer, so I don't want to just give it all to Adam, right? You don't have a co-writer on a book unless they're putting in a lot of work, so I'm sure Olivia is familiar as well. I'm just not familiar with Olivia. But judging by Adam's previous books, at least with Aftershock, he definitely has a knack for recreating historical figures in a fictional way for his stories, right? And telling something a little different based on true life events. Cause you know, all the stuff that we see here, like, actually happened, right? So Mary and Percy hanging out with Lord Byron, and going through Europe and doing this tour, because, you know, they were kind of like 19th century beatniks, right? Mm-hmm. And they even mentioned some of that here as partially as jokes, but also kind of to show us what culture is like in this era. Like when they call them – what is it they call them? Man, I can't remember. But they were talking about like their religious convictions partially, how they're like, you know, you guys are atheists and heathens or whatever. I don't know, like, what kind of sex parties you're having in here. Something like that is what's implied. Obviously, the language is a little more flowery because of the time that this is happening in. But, you know, basically these four people are just kind of traveling around. Obviously, even that in itself is against the status quo, right? Because none of them are married to each other, not yet at least. Lord Byron and Percy Shelley and Mary and I can't remember the other girl's name. That was kind of counter things, right? Like, if you're traveling, if a couple is traveling, you assume that they're married, which they're not. And, you know, Mary Shelley at this point is what, 16 or 17? She's very young. But somehow they make it work and they live this very, I just want to say like cool lifestyle, right? Like, they don't really care. Obviously they, both families have money, so they're able to travel Europe without really worrying about things, right? They rent this fancy mansion to stay in Switzerland for the whole winter. So obviously they have the means to do this kind of thing, right? Typical people just wouldn't be able to travel in Europe and rent mansions for fun. And they have good company as well, right? They have these parties and, you know, lords show up and barons and whatever. A lot of rich people showing up to these parties. So I thought that was pretty interesting, the way that whole thing is set up, and actually hearing some of that stuff from these characters that were actual figures, right? Cause sometimes you don't really get this part of the story when you're, I mean, I was an English major, so I had to read Shelley and I had to read, Frankenstein and all that stuff, both poems and the novels. And so I find that interesting when we actually get a little backstory on the people and not just on the work that they write.
Sure. And I mean, like just to do you one better, like, I'm pretty sure that the genesis of Frankenstein does actually come from a writer's retreat with these people.
Right.
You know, so he took that and turned it into the premise of the story, mm-hmm. Which is cool. Although I'm curious, like, the dynamics of that, because if we take everything at face value, like, maybe, like, are all the other characters besides Mary, like, gonna know that all this stuff is happening, and, you know, like, or is she just gonna have this secret adventure and then she writes this story about Dr. Frankenstein and they're blown away, not realizing it's, you know, not entirely fiction?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, like, the contest that they have, that was a thing. That's a historical thing, right? Where they were going to have a contest on who could write like a horror story. And obviously Mary ended up winning. That's why her book was published. So all that is true, but yeah, I'm not sure. Because like in the Frankenstein story itself, you wouldn't have characters like Shelley or Lord Byron showing up. But you do have a Mary type character in there. So maybe she is the only one going through this adventure. I mean, she does separate from the group, right? To go see what their host is doing. We should kind of set that up, right? So they get kicked out of this mansion that they rented for wintertime. And this guy shows up on horseback and he's like, my master wants you guys to just stay at the house with us for the rest of winter. And they're all kind of like, that's a little weird that some random stranger will just let us stay at their house. But all right, I guess we'll do that. Like, this would never happen now, right? This is how, like, 90s and 2000s teenage horror flicks start, right? You're traveling through the woods and your car breaks down and some stranger's like, hey, come over to the house. And then body parts start getting chopped off. You know, this is a different time, so that wouldn't happen. But, you know, because she's pregnant, she's like, yeah, I'll go check it out. They're not going to hurt me if I'm pregnant. Which I guess kind of makes sense in a way. Maybe not now, but definitely back then. And then you kind of get into the story. There's some interesting changes that I like, that I think will work well here. For example, Victor Frankenstein is Victoria Frankenstein.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, so what's your take on that? Like, you know, I certainly allow certainly for, you know, creators to whatever swap genders or reimagine characters, but it just, I don't know what to make, like, A, like what the kind of intent, like, how narratively that's gonna, like, what you draw from that thematically, that it's a woman instead of a man, but also why, in the context of story, Mary would change the gender to write the story, you know, or publish it.
So I don't think we have enough of the story to determine that yet. However, I think in terms of the fact that this group is kind of going against norms, the fact that we have this female Frankenstein as opposed to a male Frankenstein kind of goes along with that. And also I think it'll maybe play a role in the final part of the story because, you know, she's not the one publishing this, right? Her dad's going to be the one that publishes it. And as a result, based on social norms at this time, they might be like, well, we don't really want this kind of main character to be a female. We'll just change it to Victor. So that may play a role a little bit into how we go against norms in this story. I mean, there may be some message relating to that at some point. And I think the fact that Mary is the focus of this kind of has me inclined to think that will be the case in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's just funny if that's the rationale. Like they, you know, they had to change it when publishing it because it's like, oh well, you know, like dead bodies coming back from the grave. Like, no, you know, that could happen, but a woman scientist, nobody will believe that.
Well, yes, because that wasn't a thing at this time.
Yeah, I was just making a joke, like, you know,
no,
like,
I gotcha.
the whole story is fabulous, so, you know, like, I don't think that's much further to suspend your disbelief.
Sure. Well, and think about it further than that, I mean, some of the stuff that we're already seeing that Victoria does with these dead bodies is already, like, 10 times more horrific than what's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when they find the random bloody foot on the ground. So
yeah, I mean, the original book is like, that's pretty gruesome, dude, like, yeah, sewing together body parts.
Sure. And definitely more gruesome 200 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've seen some fairly scary takes on Frankenstein, but they're still pretty true to the original. And as a result, they're really not as scary as stuff that we see now. Or let me rephrase. I don't want to say scary because when I think of what Frankenstein could be now, I think of stuff that I don't think is true horror, for example, like Saw or what's the other one? Hostel. I'm not the only one, but what a lot of people call like gore porn, you know what I mean? Where it's scary because of the shock value more than it's actually scary. Or like, what's that stupid movie? Human Centipede? You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think this is really well told. I think the setup for this first issue is really fantastic. And obviously we're big fans of Adam Glass's work, so I'm sure as the story progresses, we're going to get very deep into Victoria and the rest of the story.
Yeah. Also Hayden Sherman, dude. Like, I really enjoy his work too.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. Yeah.
Okay. Final thought for me is, like, I kind of think that it's suspicious the way that this offer was made to them to come stay there.
Mm.
You know, like reading it, I was almost wondering if there was like, if maybe that's why this, you know, they crashed the carriage or something, was to like, to boot them out of their lodgings so that they would have to accept this offer, you know, like at the end, doesn't Dr. Frankenstein know Mary by name? Like I got the sense that she was taking an interest, like it's part of a plan.
Yeah. There's gotta be some kind of plan. The body that's in the lab is the guy that was killed in the carriage accident.
Yeah.
So there's definitely something else going on.
That could be that too.
Yeah. There's definitely something else going on. But so far so good, man. I like it. I love gothic horror. It's really interesting. It's a lot more suspenseful, and I think Adam and his co-writer are doing a pretty bang up job at recreating some of that stuff.
Yeah,
and Hayden's art perfect for this. I mean,
it's such a different context, you know. Like I'm used to seeing him do like futuristic stuff, mm-hmm. and so to see this naturalistic, like period stuff is very interesting.
Well, it works really well though, because I think it does capture that gothic feel. Like, think about that. If this book was in black and white, this could have been in like Creepy Magazine.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, perfect. All right, let's read it up. I guess I'll go first on this one. And my score is a 4.5 out of 5. Loved it.
Nice. I will go 4.25 out of 5.
That's not as good as my score.
It's close.
My score's better. All right, next book. Let's do, let's get Relay. Let's do Relay now.
Okay.
All right, Relay number 5, the final issue. This is written by Zach Thompson with art by Dalibor Telejic. We have a story, Zach Thompson, Eric Bromberg, and Donnie Cates. Colors by Jose Villarubia and letters by Charles Pritchett. There was a lot to take in this last issue. A lot to take in.
Yeah, dude.
I almost feel like we should have gone like one more. I feel like letting this story breathe one more issue may have made a little more sense. Because I feel like there was a big jump in story between 3 and 4 and another big jump between 4 and this issue. I think we do get a lot of questions answered, but I mean, for one, the way this book ends, it's not the end of the story, right? Yeah, even though it says end and, you know, maybe we can hope for a volume 2 where we get more of what's going on. But as much as was answered, I think the amount of questions that were brought into place were a lot more than those answers that we got. And I mean, Zach's a brilliant dude, and I love Zach's work, both for Aftershock and Black Mask and at Marvel. But he's got so many ideas in his head that sometimes it can get a little difficult to follow through to the end. I mean, like when we start getting about the alien coming to Earth. And, oh God, what's the guy's name?
Donaldson.
Donaldson getting sent out to space to send this relay system. And we have this new concept introduced about the Almanac. Like, there was just so much in this issue that I'm still trying to process some of it. And I read this twice already. I'm curious. Give me some of your thoughts.
Yeah, dude, I agree. Like, I felt like this last issue was super rushed, you know. Like I got whiplash like from kind of like how the story was being rolled out, and then it's just like, oh, and here's all of it, you know. We explain the myth and we explain what this thing is that collects stuff from the planets, you know, and it's like seems like they were really trying to close every loop. And you know, to your earlier point, like, I kind of don't think that there's going to be more if they don't take the time to say, like, end volume one, or like the end question mark, or, you know, like, to be continued, you know, something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, as far as it being an ending, it almost seems like they're kind of implying that for some reason Earth and Earth culture, but I guess specifically Earth, is necessary for the spread of the relay.
Right.
Which I don't understand why, you know, because it doesn't seem like Earth was the first planet that got the relay.
Correct.
You know, like an alien brought the relay to them. I mean, maybe it's just like they're better suited to it than other species.
So the way that I understood it is, because of the way human culture is, where we have this like innate ability to just not give a shit about anything else but us, where we just spread and spread and spread, and just take over whatever's there, right? Like, it's kind of social commentary on like culture now, right? Like, there used to be a few humans, and then we start walking around, then we like, oh, let's go to Europe, let's go to Asia, and then you know, as the centuries progress, you have other groups moving in, and you're like, oh, well, your culture sucks, my culture's better, let's go to war, and then whoever wins, that's the culture that progresses. Like, that kind of ability for one human culture to override another is a perfect fit for what the relay system's trying to do. And as a result, when the relay system spreads throughout the galaxy, they want to instill human culture into every place that is colonized, because human culture always overrides, whenever it wins, it overrides whatever already exists there. And so it's kind of using it as a mechanism to spread itself. Because really, that's its goal, right? The relay wants to spread itself throughout the whole universe. And here's this species that does exactly that, and has done that exactly through their entire history.
Just so it's kind of like Agent Smith's like monologue in The Matrix, where he's like, yeah, humans are a virus.
Yeah.
It's just like you multiply until you destroy the host, and then you move on or whatever. So yep. It's like, so maybe they're focusing on that part of it, and like, I guess that's part of the theme, you know, like, yeah. I guess I can get that. I don't necessarily understand why destroying Earth really, like, if every planet in the relay is now populated by humans, like, what difference does Earth make in that? Like, they're gonna now launch a wide scale, like, I don't know, like, war, like, across the universe or whatever. But, you know, like, why? I'm not sure how just destroying Earth, like, is an end if that's what they're going for.
Yeah, I think that confused me as well, because there's two ends presented here, right? Like, for one, they explicitly mention destroying Earth. And I agree, what does that have to do with anything, right? Like, okay, that's where Donison started. That's, like, the birthplace of humanity. So maybe, like, as a gesture of some sort, but that still doesn't get rid of the relay system. The only way to get rid of the relay system is to travel through the system until they get to the, what's the aliens called? The Ingrix or something like that? Until they get to, like, their point of origin. Because that's where the Almanac is, which is, like, the main hub of the relay system. That's yeah, really the only way to get rid of the relay system, is to get rid of the Almanac. Because they even said, like, if we start going around destroying parts of the relay system, they'll just come in and fix it. Well, then what's the point of destroying them if they're going to come fix it? You need to hit it at the source.
Yeah, maybe doing that somehow is going to reveal the location of the hub or something. But yeah, sure. I was pretty confused by that.
Mm-hmm. One idea that I thought was kind of interesting, though, is how all of these planets that are part of the relay system, even though, like, every time we see one, it's always humans, they didn't originally start as humans. Because when the relay system is put there, or when the relay is put into a planet, and it rewrites that culture with the relay culture that's really human culture, it also rewrites the species that is there biologically to look like humans. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's like reverse assimilation, I guess, kind of. You know, it's like an invader comes in and he turns you into them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Except, like, this happens physically, right? Like, when an invader comes in and replaces your culture with theirs, like, I mean, like, for one, you're both humans, so, like, there's none of that. But you could do, like Neanderthals, right? When humans started colonizing Europe and didn't just, like, kill Neanderthals, right? They started interbreeding as well. So, sure, they killed a bunch of them, but some weren't killed. They integrated into human society and bred. And so you have people with, like, Neanderthal DNA, right? Or, like, an Asia Denisovan DNA. Eventually, those species go away, but somehow they're still part of the culture. And that's one of the reasons they want to start destroying these relays, because when they destroy the relay, these people can see beyond the fact that they're not just part of this culture. And they can remember some of their original culture. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting ideas here. I just feel like there just was not enough space in this comic to tell them all.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it could have used 5-10 more issues for all that stuff, you know?
Sure.
Like, I was so amped on this, like, series when it started up. Like, it seemed so interesting, you know? And, like, I don't know, like, all the places that it might have gone or whatever, it just seems like it kind of, it, like, stopped right here, you know? Mm. And I guess, obviously, it did. But, like, now I don't really know where they were going with all of it, you know?
I don't know if I agree with that entirely. I mean, I get it. I just don't feel like, for one, that this issue was long enough, and two, that five issues were really long enough to tell this kind of story. Like, if you did this as a novel, this would have been, like, a 500-page novel. And I don't know what Zach's scripts look like, you know? He from my understanding, he's pretty detailed in his scripts. But even then, like, you're still working within the confines of a 22-page comic. And I think sometimes it's hard to put big ideas into that small amount of space.
Yeah, I agree. And like, this issue, like, there was a lot of reading, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there were a lot of pages that were all text.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like in one or two places, like, it almost felt like they were talking in circles. Mm. Like, Donaldson spends, like, you know, five pages explaining stuff to Jad, and then he explains some of the same stuff to the lady when she shows up, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I kind of was like, oh, I'm getting a little tired here.
I hear you. All right, let's wrap it up. Final thoughts?
I wish that there was more. Like, I wonder if it got cut short, but yeah, that's my feeling on that.
I do wonder that as well. I know a couple of issues were delayed. Issue 3 was really late, right? Or was it 4? One of those issues was really delayed, like 2 months. And I know that, you know, Zach is doing work at Marvel, so I'm sure contractually, like, that's a priority. And it may have had some effect on this story. I do wonder how this story would have been different had that not been the case. And it could be wrong, so if I'm wrong, by all means, let me know.
Yeah, let us know, Zach.
Yeah, let us know. All right, let's rate it up. Travis.
I'm going to go 3 out of 5.
All right, I am going to go 3.5 out of 5. I love the concepts. I just wish we had more time to explain them all, because there's a lot in here. I mean, dude, Zach's always that way, right? When we were doing Her Infernal Descent. Like, there was a lot in that book.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways. All right, I'm going to let you pick the next one. We've got Stronghold and Animosity.
I think that I'm leaning towards doing Animosity last. So, you want to do Stronghold next?
Man, I am reading your mind today, buddy.
Nice.
I knew you would want to do Animosity last. All right, Stronghold number 3. This is written by Phil Hester with art by Ryan Kelly. We have colors by D. Cuniff and letters by Simon Boland. I think this kind of suffers from the opposite. It suffers is the bad word. Let me not say that. This is kind of like the opposite of what we just talked about. Because I think Stronghold also has a lot of really big ideas. But I think the way that things were explained in this issue made it all fit together pretty nicely and made a lot of sense. I think we still don't like really know what's going on, but obviously now we know that the Primacy kind of went crazy at one point and killed a bunch of people. And that's why the adversary does what he does, because he wants the Primacy to remember the pain and suffering that he has caused. And I think that goes pretty well with what we talked about for issue two, how maybe the adversary is not necessarily the bad guy. And sure, he killed a bunch of people. I mean, he killed a stadium full of people, him and his people. But there's a reason for that. Maybe revenge is not the best reason. But that is his reasoning, right? The Primacy killed his home planet, everybody in his home planet, and he wants him to feel that same pain that he felt.
Yeah, I mean, at the risk, though, of, like, reigniting the war and it's like, you know, what if the Primacy goes off the handle and, like, and starts attacking those other planets again, you know?
Well, all right, that's the risk. However, what if he doesn't? What if
he goes back against the stronghold instead?
Well, what if this is the event where the Primacy realizes all the terrible crap that he's done and finally decides to put an end to it? I mean, obviously the stronghold is still not the good guys, right? The only reason that they have him in this like matrix type situation is because they also don't want him to kill everybody, including them. They're not like really worshiping him. They're keeping him at bay.
I mean, I thought that like he was on their side somehow, that like that they were on his side in the war or something. So
yes, I think they were on his side at the war. However, the actions that he took during the war maybe were a little much even for the stronghold, right? Like those were his people, but he went batshit crazy basically. Right, like you only see that one panel where it's like him against like 1,000 dudes, and he's just like killing them left and right. But obviously, I feel like the stronghold realized like this guy may be too powerful. Right, if we piss him off, he's going to kill us also. So let's put him in this place where he feels safe, and he feels like he's totally normal, and that way we protect ourselves, and we'll create this whole mythology around the Primacy or whatever. So people around us can continue to uphold this fantasy. But really they were trying to protect themselves. And then you have people like the Hold Mother who really just want him to unleash his powers, to some extent, or at least be able to harness some of that ability.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Okay. My thought though is, I thought that the adversary suggested something along the lines of that Michael, like the Primacy, or I think they call him the Zealot, yeah. Like flipped out and launched a 1,000-year war, mm-hmm. You know, and I got the sense that that was in response to a slaughter, but like I almost thought it was, you know, a slaughter perpetrated by the enemy.
Yeah, I get the sense as well.
So, like, they went too far and then, you know, suffered the consequences, I guess. So, I, you know, maybe, I don't know, like, do they feel any remorse for their, like, role in the situation?
You know, that whole thing's a little weird, right? I mean, war itself is a little weird. Like, hey, you killed my goat, so I'm going to go kill your kids. Oh, well, you killed all my kids. Let me go kill your whole town. And then, like, where does it stop, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, this goes to the extreme, and it doesn't stop because there's trillions of people, species, beings, whatever, that get killed as a result of this war. And how it started, it seems to be basically what the Primacy did in the adversary's homeworld. Like, there was this war going on, and the adversary's people killed the Primacy's family or whatever. And then he flipped his crap because he's super powerful and ended up just killing planets at a time to get his revenge.
Yeah, it's just asymmetrical warfare. It's like, yo, we, you know, killed like a stadium's worth of people and you killed a trillion people.
Right.
You know, like usually we escalate those, you know, it's, you know, like we up the ante gradually, you know, like, you know, like play around a little bit.
Yeah.
But like you went too far, bro.
Yeah, you went a little too far. But at the same time, I still believe the adversary is really not all that bad, right? Because I still feel like, just based on the stuff that he said, that he wants the Primus to experience this big sense of loss, so the cycle will end, right? He'll be like, look, I'm a piece of crap. I kill all these people. You only killed 50,000. I killed trillions. Like, I'm a piece of crap. I'm gonna get out of the system, and I'll deal with all the death that I caused and, you know, people to suffer, and just leave me the hell alone. I think ultimately that's the goal.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is that I'm guessing that they're kind of going for basically a kind of like, you know, both sides are wrong, you know, like kind of like morally gray theme, you know,
mm-hmm.
like that it's not absolutes in a sense.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
So they both seem to have a lot of bad stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And yet they're neither of them are totally wrong.
Sure. So at the end, the Primacy's kind of captured, and the Holdmother puts this butterfly machine on his face.
Yeah.
How do you feel like that's going to play out? Because I have an idea, and I think there's hints to that in this issue.
Huh. Well, I want to hear your idea. The one thing that I don't know where that's going. But I will say that it's interesting that Claire is basically there right now, you know? So who knows what she's up to, but sure. That's all I have to offer.
So they hook up to this machine, right? This like real matrix thing that they've built, that the stronghold has built. Because this life that they've given them, even though it's all fake, because everybody around them is part of the stronghold and they're creating this illusion life for him. This machine that they built is an actual illusion, right? Like he's not going to be, I mean, his body will be in the world, but his mind is in this fake reality. But the thing is, we already see that he can see through all that stuff, right? When he goes home and they've got the cameras or whatever in the house, or it's not cameras. It like the whole house is a camera, right? They can just choose coordinates in the room to peek out of. Like every time they change that camera coordinate, he looks up and he looks into the camera and they're like, oh, he can see us. They're like, yeah, there's no way. Like there's not a camera there. Like the whole thing's a camera. Switch to this other coordinate. And when they do that, like he looks over there and they change it again and he looks over there. So obviously like he can already see through the facade of everything that's going on. And it's not like a real physical camera, right? So my assumption is he can easily break out of this new prison that they've built him, this like literal matrix that they're going to put him in, because he can already sense what's real and what's not. Just like in the Matrix, you know, when he starts having his powers in the real world, when he's no longer in the Matrix, he can like stop the Sentinels or whatever.
Let's not go there, dude.
I think that part is actually genius, but we're not going to talk about that now because I know everybody hates it. Including you, apparently. I think it's very smart the way that it's done. We're not going to talk about it right now. But that kind of thing.
Sure, yeah.
Where like he's become awakened to reality. And so no matter what illusion you put him in, he can already tell the difference between illusion and reality.
Yeah, I mean, the alternative to that would be that, like, my take on the thing is it's like you're saying the Matrix, but it's almost kind of like a neuralizer that you run him through so many fake lifetimes or something that he's bound to forget this revelation and go back to, they can program whatever memories they want. So if that's what it is, then the alternative would be the next issue, he's back to not knowing what's up and, you know, but I mean, maybe Claire just gonna step out and shut it down, you know, and like on the beginning of the next issue.
Yeah, I mean, it could be as simple as that, right? And we know Claire that is there, right? She's posing as a stronghold heavy armor soldier. So, yeah, she's there. But even through that, like, we already know the power that he has, right? And he's starting to realize his power. As a result, I don't think that it even matters how many realities they put him through, right? Like, that's their safeguard, right? Like, they're gonna change reality so quickly that he can't adapt to it. But the thing is, he's still living those realities, right? It's like a relative time thing. So, like, even though in his mind, he's living this stuff in real time, right? Like, each life is whatever, 70 years, 80 years. In real reality, those things might only take, you know, a second, 2 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever. But he's living a lifetime in this short period of time. I think he's got so much power that might work for a little while. He might go through a couple hundred simulations, but eventually his abilities will catch up to that, and he'll still be able to see reality from illusion.
Yeah, I definitely a possibility. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Sorry.
No worries.
What else? Any thoughts? Final thoughts?
Okay, I guess as a final thought, I'm slightly unclear if the Stronghold has a presence outside Earth, because clearly the force of the adversary, you know, inhabit, like, the universe and multiple planets and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that we've gotten any indication so far that the Stronghold is anything but people on Earth, you know? Mm. So, I don't know. If there is a Stronghold that's on other planets that has aliens or something, you know, that's interesting. But I just don't know how you can really have a war between something that operates off one planet and something that's a galactic empire.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't think the Stronghold is just on Earth. I think we've only just seen them on Earth because they look human-like and they've got him in this fake St. Louis. You know, the only reason that we know that the adversary is off-world is because he's obviously an alien.
Yeah. And they show, like pictures of them being on other planets, what appear to be alien landscapes.
Right. And, I mean, while a lot of people in Michael's life may be Stronghold people, or maybe all of them, we do know that it's not like the whole planet is just a Stronghold colony and everybody is Stronghold. Right, like there's a ton of normal people living in this world.
Yeah.
All right, let's rate it up. I guess I'll go first, and I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I think I'll also go 4 out of 5.
Good choice. Final book of the night, Animosity number 20. This is written by Marguerite Bennett. We have art by Elton Tomasi, colors by Rob Schwaggy P. Schwager, and letters by Taylor, not Despacito, Esposito. All right, so this was your final pick. So tell me why you wanted to do this book last.
Okay, so I was very surprised and, you know, pleasantly so, very pleased that kind of now they're really starting to address certain mechanics of the premise, you know? Like, I feel like the whole time, really, there hasn't been much time spent on how did the wake happen, you know? And, like, how are these animals physically talking? How are they physically thinking, you know? Like, and, you know, personally, I tend to get wrapped up in those kind of premise details, like, more than other people. So I acknowledge that probably a lot of people are just like, yeah, whatever, it doesn't matter, you know? But clearly they're bringing it up now for a reason, you know? So I thought that was interesting. And, you know, I'm also interested that these snakes, you know, seem to be more motivated to figure out why this is happening than most, you know, like the humans wanted to know why it happens. And that's understandable because they were trying to reverse it. But is that the same reason why the snakes want to figure out why it happens?
Yeah, I think there's some really interesting stuff that's brought in here. And obviously, Marguerite is a freaking brilliant person and obviously knows a lot about a lot of things. I love the quasi-religious use of snakes as the animals that want to find out why this is happening. And they even mentioned in the issue, right? Snakes have throughout history been known as like holders of wisdom, and knowledge and things like that. So of course they want to know why this happened, right? If they are the keepers of knowledge and they have knowledge that they don't have, then of course they want to have it because they're going to be the ones to transmit that knowledge to others. I think the way that that whole thing is happening is kind of interesting because they basically put Jesse and Sandor in a DMT trip,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I don't know if they actually give him peyote, but they mention peyote. I think it may be some kind of combination of some plants and snake venom, from what I understand. I don't know of any snakes that have like hallucinogenic properties. Maybe they do, but it reminded me of like 5-MeO-DMT, which comes from a frog. So maybe it's like something similar to that. And I think the way the experience is described is really interesting. It's a little vague at first, right? Because they talk about other animals that they bring in to kind of go and talk to God, like animal God or human God or whatever. But they can't like really always get the exact experience because the experience is so great and deep that none of these animals have the language required to explain what it is that they see. So I think that's part of the reason they want Jesse to come in, because number one, they know that Jesse is different from other humans. Because remember, a lot of the humans are just really trying to survive, right? So they're all doing really shitty things. And Jesse is not, right? Like everything that we've seen Jesse do makes sense for the better of everybody, human and animal alike. So she's obviously different as a human, and maybe because she's human, she'll be able to relate this mystical experience better than others.
Yeah, I don't know if I necessarily fully subscribe to that. Like, my one quibble is that it seems to me like all the animals basically have just whatever, a preternatural vocabulary. Like, I don't, for the most part, sense really a big difference in their vocabulary or intelligence from animal to human, from, you know, like, so I don't know that Jesse per se has tools that the cow and the chicken didn't have, you know, or the horse rather. But yeah, I think it's interesting. I guess I'm curious because they reference that both the horse and the chicken saw something when they took the venom.
Right.
So, and they like, all that they will say is I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it. So that's pretty tantalizing, and I wonder if Jesse and Sandor are in for some bad times in the next issue.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, they don't have the anti-venom either, right? Because that's the reason the horse was there. They run their mm-hmm. poison through the horse, and the horse creates like a natural antitoxin.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they could have made the anti-venom before the horse ran off. You know, like maybe they had a dose ready to go, but they just can't make any more. But
sure.
Yeah. Snake venom seems like pretty deadly. So that's not a great plan.
Yeah. Well, obviously it's not your typical snake venom because they go on a massive trip in that last panel.
Yeah, it looks pretty fun.
It does look fun. I need to find me some snakes.
Oh, I got a guy, dude. Don't worry.
Man, oh man. Uh-huh. Sure you do, buddy. Sure you do.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed this whole thing. I'm curious what Ronnie would have said about this. We should find out and have him talk about it next time.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's like it could be potentially like some huge bombshells for just the whole series, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what do you think Jesse's going to say? Do you think we'll see Jesse's hallucination, or will we just open up with her trying to explain what she sees?
No, I figure we're going to see it.
Yeah.
Like firsthand, you know, like, I think that her and Sandor, I think they're both tripping. So I think they're going to be having the same trip, you know, and it's just going to be like a crazy fantasy thing. I don't know, but how you could necessarily take whatever they're seeing in this thing and assume that it's true, you know, versus just like crazy hallucinations, you know, like, like there's no accounting for that. So I guess it kind of just becomes like, well, what do you want to believe about it? You know,
sure.
Like, and I know I'm sure most people don't really care why all this is happening, you know, but, I don't know. I guess I never thought of it being magic, because that is really the explanation that kind of makes the most sense.
Sometimes the simplest explanation is the truest explanation. Yeah, I like the reasoning behind the snake saying that it's magic, right? Because no matter how you try to explain it, every possible explanation makes the same amount of sense. Like, oh, it's scientists. Oh, it's God. Oh, it's magic. Or it's, you know, whatever. An experiment. Like, it's all the same.
Yeah, I mean, it seems, if they're trying to have, like, a religious type experience, you know, like a vision quest or whatever, like, maybe they're kind of conflating magic with divinity, you know? Like, they're lumping it in or something. But I guess I'm interested, like, I don't know the exact saying or who it's attributed to, but there's something that maybe it's Mulder, but it's like if you eliminate all possibilities, you know, the one that's left, however unlikely, is the truth.
Yeah. Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth.
Agent Mulder.
Nope. Try again.
Carl Sagan.
Oh, man. Nope. Think older.
Martini.
it's from Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, see,
cool. So,
aren't you glad you have an English major here?
I am, dude. Like, you're cleaning up.
Oh, man. Yeah, to go back to your previous question, I find it interesting that the snakes are the ones doing this. But I think it makes a lot of sense, like, biologically, right? Think about every being that we've met in this series, right? Humans and animals alike. They're all just trying to survive. And if you look at a snake, like, I mean, snakes can go, what, like months, years without eating? So they don't necessarily need to worry so much about their physical survival. So, cause, you know, they can take their time, right? They eat one animal, they're good for years. So they can invest their time in trying to actually figure out what's happening. Whereas nobody else has the time to do that because they're just looking, like, where am I going to get my next meal from?
Yeah, sure.
I like it.
Yeah, okay. I also, though, I think it maybe is also just a very interesting idea if what they're going for is, like, you know, it's the same reason why humans are interested in where life and intelligence comes from, you know? You know, like, we're in the same way that humans try to figure out where the universe came from, like, maybe that's why the snakes want to figure out why they suddenly gain consciousness.
Sure.
Because it's like the same thing, kind of.
Sure.
I think, therefore, I am.
Mm. Subito ergo sum.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That one, I think, is Mulder.
Good try, buddy. Good try. I think it's, I think this series has gone into a, very interesting place. A place that I really like because, as you and I talked about in Chicago, I'm very interested in this kind of consciousness work.
Yes. The one thing I would say, though, is that it's always been extremely interesting, you know? So now it's just like, diving into another avenue,
mm-hmm.
you know, but there, I don't think there's any issues that doesn't bring up some really heavy, you know, conceptual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I don't know. It's, I don't know. It's, I kind of think it's the marquee Aftershock book.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I just thought about this. You brought up the, I think therefore I am thing. I wonder if that will play something into this. You know, we're talking about like consciousness work and stuff, like where does consciousness come from, all that. I mean, obviously that's a thing that philosophers have debated for, you know, millennia or whatever. But you know, when the animals gain the ability to speak, they also gain like conscious thought, right? And that goes perfectly with that quote. The animals really weren't a thing before, but now that they can think, they actually exist.
Yeah. Mm. And yeah, like their concept of reality exists.
Yeah.
Like, you know, does reality exist if you know, they can't perceive it? I don't know.
Mm. Does reality
exist? I blew your mind, Grace.
You don't want me to go down this rabbit hole. Ronnie's heard some of my crazy theories. That is not crazy what you just said.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's like, I don't know. There's a lot of philosophical territory there, yeah. You know? Like the tree falling in the woods and stuff.
Ah, yes. If a bear shits in the woods and no one's there to see it, did he have to take a shit?
Was there a picnic basket?
The answer, by the way, is no.
To both?
Yes.
Okay.
Because if you don't see it, then it doesn't exist.
Yes. I don't know. I don't think we'll answer that question on this episode.
Where's Ronnie? We need to talk about the quantum wave function. We can get into some physics territory. You know about quantum wave function? Have you heard about this?
No, I don't think so. All right, so are you talking about where it's like a wave and a particle?
Kind of. Yeah, I mean, it's very much related. So like when you – light is either a wave or a particle depending on if you're observing it or not. The same kind of thing. Like what was it, the Schrodinger's cat thing? Is the cat dead or alive in the box? Well, you don't know until you open the box and look inside. And apparently like this is how the universe works in like quantum particles, right? Particles exist in both states. They exist and don't exist. And until you actually look at them, they don't have a definite meaning to them, right? They exist in both states. They are and they are not. But it's not until you see them that the wave function collapses and you get the result.
Yes, it's like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Right.
Yes, either the meth is blue or it is not blue.
But we all saw it was blue.
Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. And very pure. All right, let's rate this one up.
All right, I'm going 5 out of 5 as usual.
I am going 35 out of 5 as usual. I love it. You know, Marguerite does things in comics that I don't think anybody else has the balls to do.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's heavy, dude. Like, look how long we talked about it. You know, like, mm-hmm. And it's every issue is like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right.
But it's accessible, too.
Very much so. Very much so. Especially for a couple smart guys like us.
Ah. Oh, okay. Okay, one thing, though, uh-huh. Is I was confused what was with all the Halloween decorations. So, Marguerite, what's up with that?
Because it's magic, bro. You remember when Sandor sees them, they're like, what is this, a witchcraft coven?
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, we're kind of a coven.
Yeah, somebody carved those jack-o'-lanterns recently, dude. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think it was the snakes. I've never seen a snake carve a pumpkin.
Nah.
Mm. All right, that's it for this week's books. Next week, we only have one book, and that book is Dark Red number 2. We really liked the first one, so I'm looking forward to see how that discussion goes. And I think Travis and I decided next week will be... Red versus Blue. So we'll also be talking about Out of the Blue, which we haven't talked about yet.
Yes. Finally, we're talking about it.
Finally. I know we've been saying we're going to talk about it for like 3 weeks. So we will finally talk about Out of the Blue and then Dark Red number 2. Maybe in that order, maybe not. Who knows? Anyways, if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter. Ronnie is at Rumbar316. Tell him you missed him. Travis is at The Great Magnet. I'm at Geekbot, and the show is at Aftershock Pod. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.